Good?
Bad.
WTF. Well, I'm
thinking.
Welcome back to episode 73 of The Good, The Bad, and The WTF, What Are They Thinking? Peter, how are we?
Covered in mosquito bites.
Covered in mosquito? Where are you?
I'm eating alive around here. I've just been, for the last 3 days, I've just been a night buffet for mosquitoes.
Well, what, inside? Are you keeping inside, windows open?
Yeah. No, I have kept them open inside.
Okay.
It's way too hot to have them shut.
You've had the luxury of aircon, I imagine.
No, there's no aircon here.
That's awful.
This is an old hotel. There's no aircon here.
Oh, shit. That is something that has been widely debated on social media. Everyone's saying, people from London, people from the UK moaning about the heat. They should try and live in this country, that country. It's just like, the difference is we are not prepared. We are shadows of ourselves in this heat.
Our houses are not built for the kind of weather that we experience at the moment. And that's the truth.
Not at all. But at risk of this being another weather chat, which it seems to be at these times now, we're through the heat. We made it. We had 39, 40. It was horrible. But
42.
Yeah, it wasn't good. I put a little tweet out on our Twitter because it just appeared to me. I thought, I heard a song, and I'm convinced it's the best song that's ever been made. I think you disagree.
It sounds like Tenacious D. This is the greatest and best song in the world.
Yeah, this is the greatest and best song in the world. In my opinion, it's a complete song. It's perfect. It takes you through all the emotions, takes you on a journey. Rufus Du Sol's In a Bloom, I think, is an absolute masterpiece. In my opinion, Peter doesn't agree with me. But
I think you overhyped it, as you usually do with things.
When I get excited, I get excited. I can't help it. But it got me thinking, because when I listen to, sometimes you listen to a song and you think, this really takes me somewhere, or this really makes me reflect on stuff. What song would you want to hear if you were watching your life flash before your eyes? So let's say you're going to die and you get your whole life flashing before your eyes, which I kind of hope happens. I wouldn't mind, living, especially the best bits, leave out the bits of me on the toilet and stuff like that.
That might be your best bit. Remember that shit in 2015?
Hey, that was a pretty good shit. Yeah, that, to be fair, it would be some people's best bits, including me, maybe. It kind of needs a soundtrack as well, doesn't it? Like all of the things you do whenever you piece together, and especially people on TikTok, they'll go on holiday and then they'll do like a 30-second video, and it'll be everything they did on holiday. And you look at it, you go, "Fucking that holiday looked amazing!" But it always does, because when it's all plunked together in 30 seconds, everything looks amazing. But
imagine if every day was 30 seconds; it'd be amazing. It'd be the best 30 seconds of every day.
It's just like done. What song would you want to hear as your life is flashing before your eyes?
Well, I hope not a short song. I suppose you want a longer song.
That's why I picked this one. 9 minutes.
That you had, I can't think of many 9 minute songs. I don't know. I've come very unprepared for this conversation. I suppose when I think of songs, I always think of like really ones that are probably like no good for like This Is Your Life, but songs that are have got a little bit of grit under the fingernails, I kind of like songs like that, like maybe something from like Led Zeppelin, When the Levee Broke, or something like that. That'd be a cool song to hear as your life passes before your eyes.
You'd be like, wow, my life was pretty cool.
Well, no, I like to see that with like the most mundane things, like give me Shelter by Rolling Stones while I'm clipping my toenails. You know, so, like, that would be brilliant. It's like great music to something so mundane.
That'd be awful, wouldn't it? That'd actually be awful. Clipping your toenails.
Anyone who hears this in the future, you know, if you're going to put up like photos of me or like a PowerPoint like presentation, you have to have one of me clipping my toenails. That has to be in there. Because it has to be something funny. I don't want all these doom and gloom. Put me clipping my toenails. Someone has to do that.
Is there anything that exists of you clipping your toenails? I mean, I wouldn't expect that there's a picture. Are you going to take a picture and then put it in your like your wheel or something?
You know what? I might. Or I might just like one day clip my toenails, and if someone's nearby, I'll say, hey, take a photo of this.
And they were like,
take a video.
They were like,
take
no.
A video, take a few.
They were like, fuck you, I'm not doing that.
This is for my funeral. I need all aspects of my life covered here.
I imagine if you start clipping your toenails, the room immediately evacuates and there's no one around to take that picture. That's what I imagine.
What you saying, like the debris of my toenails is so hazardous that it might kill people.
It's a pretty horrible habit, isn't it? If like you wouldn't do it in public.
It's a horrible habit.
Anything,
you have to do it.
Anything you wouldn't do in public is a horrible habit. Would you sit on a park bench and start clipping your toenails?
No.
And then there you go. It's a bad. Then it's a horrible habit. No one wants to see it. Yeah, I don't want to see anyone clipping their toenails.
Who brings nail clippers out to the park?
But that's what I'm saying.
That's just weird.
Well, you wouldn't do it if you had guests.
Oh, I'm going to so do that now.
I'm there.
Dinner table, just slunk my feet on the dinner table and just start clipping it away, dropping it into people's pea soup.
Nah, that's horrible. Yeah, you would be an unbearable guest.
A host, you mean?
Host, yeah. Oh, yeah, I suppose you would be a host. Everyone would fucking leave. He's been clipping his toenails again.
I think it's getting late. Party is like 30 minutes, so like, 31 minutes, get your feet out. That's one way to like.
31 minutes.
Oh,
yeah. 31 minutes.
How long do you like guests in your house?
It depends what's
max
happening.
Half an hour.
Half an hour. You can't throw a dinner
Nothing's
party.
Nothing's happening that much.
What about a dinner party?
Yeah, but they're just messy.
Your dinner parties last less than 30 minutes. So what the hell are we eating? Pot noodle?
No.
What do you mean?
How long? We just eat. We eat.
No, but you have to prepare the food.
I prepare it before they come.
Okay, so you prepare the food before they come.
They walk
through the door. They sit down. The food is on the table immediately. Because when you're having a dinner,
it's more like a conveyor belt. So you just like put them on a conveyor belt and just like plop it onto their plate. They eat it. It goes towards the kitchen. They drop it off there towards the living room. Just say hi, bye. Whoa, what are you watching? And then straight out the door. That's a 30-minute conveyor belt system.
I don't like this.
I'm going to Dragon's Den with that invention.
You shouldn't. You bloody shouldn't.
I should.
You shouldn't.
So many people say practical. No one has time in the day, so like a conveyor belt system of stuff like that would be good. You can put it on TikTok and be amazing. Yeah. Like a 30-second conveyor belt episode.
Maybe on TikTok. Yeah. Anyway, let's get into the main event. Red Rocket.
I just want to say something, and I'm going to make this fact. I don't know if you agree with me here. I think it is criminal that Simon Rex was not nominated for an Oscar in this movie.
I'd have to agree. But he's just not Oscar material, is he? There seems to be like a certain character that gets ignored, and I feel like Simon Rex is one of those characters that the Oscars wouldn't take in as a serious actor. But this is the power of our man Sean Baker. Sean Baker is a fantastic director, and he works outside the box. We know that. We know that from his past films. This man will just be like, he'll run with a feeling. You know, he's the type of guy that runs with a feeling. He's like, I feel like it's going to work with this guy. We're doing it. Fuck it. We're going to make it happen. And he's been successful with everything he's done before in that sense. And he did it with Simon Rex. Simon Rex, would you have expected, like, I don't know, you may not have known him from like the Vine days and like all of that stuff, but that's where I knew him from. And he was in Scary Movie, those sort of shit movies. And it was kind of like, he was just kind of like a guy who, and he did like a few songs as well, like a few parody songs. He's just kind of that guy who's just about, I'd never take him seriously as an actor. And then you watch this and you go, it's kind of like in football or sport, you know, a coach and a player. You know, some players, they only play well when they have a certain coach. Rex has found his coach with Sean Baker.
I didn't know much about Simon and Rex before this. I remember some of the vines. I remember Scary Movie. I don't think I've ever seen him in anything serious. It's always been quite... He's always played like the idiot from what I can remember. And actually, it feels like all those idiot characters have been perfectly aligned for him to play this magnificent idiot, because this might be the king of the idiots that he's ever played. And possibly the biggest douchebag ever on screen.
Yeah, he's not very likable, is he? He is horrible. To be fair, this film is full of people who are unlikable. There is probably no one who you'd want to be friends with on the outside world.
Painfully, you're probably friends with all of them, though. That's the sad thing.
They're because they're real. They're
so real and so... I have to say, this might be Sean Baker's funniest movie. I was casting my mind back. I mean, Tangerine and Florida Project are two movies that stride with drama and a little bit of comedy through, but this one felt like it was the funniest one he did. There were moments in this movie where I was genuinely chuckling.
Go on,
I don't know if I was meant to chuckle at scenes. I mean, obviously the best one for me was the scene where they had the 46 car crash.
Oh yeah,
that itself is hilarious. Not for the fact that there was a 46 car crash, but just the aftermath of it. The fact that it's like Mikey. What's his surname? Mikey. Let's just call him Mikey. Mikey seems to... He's this guy that seems to think he's more
Saber.
Famous.
Saber.
Popular.
Mikey Saber, sorry.
That was his porn star name.
Davis or something like that. Or Davies.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. So he seems to think he's a lot more famous than he actually is.
Mm.
So of course this 46 car crash happens and he gets out of the car. And it's the same thing he said to Lonnie, who was like his sort of neighbor, sort of tag-along friend, when he found out that he was basically scamming people pretending he worked in the army, was, how could you do this to me? You know, this could ruin me. He's very self-centered. So, of course, it's not the fact that there's these 46 car crashes. It's not the fact that there's so many victims. It's the fact that he thinks he's going to be fingered and that's going to be the end of it. And so he distances himself from Lonnie. Lonnie goes away. Lonnie gets the shit end of the stick. Like, probably the worst out of all the characters.
Yeah, he does. And he's arguably probably the most likable one, actually.
And he's pretty unlikable.
He's probably the most likable, though, out of all of them. There isn't much competition. He might be the most likable character.
He's the most pathetic character.
Yeah, that makes him a little bit more likable, I guess. You kind of feel bad for
him. Yeah, you've got a little bit more sympathy for him because you kind of fear that he's the one that you can, out of all these people, I mean, I could never be a porn star, so I suppose the closest thing I can come to is a guy who would pretend to work as a soldier because I'm not a drug dealer either. So, you know, my window is very limited in this world.
I suppose that scene's the best bit about that scene is when he gets out of the car and he just throws up. Just pure pathetic panic.
It's like something out of South Park.
Someone being sick unexpectedly in movies is always funny. Like when it just comes out of nowhere, it's always funny. And Sean Baker likes a bit of sick in his movies, doesn't he? He's fond of a bit of puking in movies. Maybe that's his thing. played by Ethan Darbone, who I don't know if it was his first role. It might be his first ever role, like first major role. Yeah, it is. First credit.
It feels like apart from Simon Rex, they're all kind of newcomers.
Mm. They're all very newcomers. He was a waiter when Sean Baker approached him while scouting locations for Red Rocket, and he asked him to audition for the role. I love that about Sean Baker. That man is just about... Just trying to find people.
That's the thing. I mean, it's the same with the one that played June. He spotted her when she was walking her dog and he just loved her look. He casts. I know in this one he casts everyone because he's the casting agent. I'm not sure if he's the same in the next one, but it feels very low-budget filmmaking, what Sean Baker does. He's got his fingers in all the pies. You know, he edits, he writes. He didn't do the cinematography on this one. He obviously did it in Tangerine, famously the iPhone movie. I don't know if he did it in the Florida Project, but what I like about this movie and the rest of his movies is there's a script. I know because listening to the trivia, Simon Rex earned all his dialogue instantaneously, but it feels so natural. It does not feel like there's a script.
Yeah, I think
it just feels like, it feels like Mike Lee in a way. It just feels like Sean Baker comes in the day and says, we're going to do this today.
I think that is one of his inspirations as well, Mike Lee, which you can see, and it's probably why I quite enjoy his movies as well, because I like Mike Lee. I think it does have a script. I think you're right. I think there is definitely improvisation, because these aren't professional actors. So getting the realness out of them, which he always seems to want in his movies, is probably when they're improvising scenes. That probably plays a lot into it in being natural and organic. So yeah, definitely.
And it's not the only one at the moment. I mean, we've got I was going to say three, but technically four, including Sean Baker, of directors that like to blend in acting with non-acting. And for some reason, I actually think it works wonderful to have that, because I think it makes it more authentic. And the other two directing teams are Chloe Zhao, who obviously won for No Man Land. She's brilliant. That she did it with No Man Land, The Rider, and what was that movie she made? Songs My Brother Taught or something like, or Father Taught or something like that, which is a good one. And the Safdie brothers, obviously, with Good Time and Uncut Gems and Heaven Knows What and Daddy Long Legs and all of that. They're very good at that. So at the moment, we've got a lot of indie filmmakers that are dabbling in professional actors and non-professional actors and finding a nice harmony between the two. And I'd probably say out of those three director teams, Sean Baker's probably the best. And I don't know about you, where would you sit this among his movies so far?
It's up there. It might even be his best. Tangerine was very good. It was very good. That sort of stands out as one of his best. It'd be an interesting ranking list, but maybe it's definitely too soon to do
definitely
one for
too
him.
Soon, yeah. I feel this one feels like he's perfected everything.
Yeah.
Like, I love Tangerine, but you know, it's like early doors of a director. Mm. Florida Project feels like after the success of Tangerine, he's got a little bit more freedom. Mm. And this one just feels like, I want to say the word more comfortable. He feels like he's more comfortable here than the rest of his work. Just feels, everything feels right. The pace and the editing is brilliant. I think the cinematography is great. I think the acting's great. I think Simon Rex just delivers this powerful performance. I'd say it's one of, I'm thinking of like the actors that were nominated for the Oscars that year. Obviously, I haven't seen Will Smith, Garfield, or Javier Bardem's performances, but I've seen Cumberbatch's and Denzel Washington's, and I can quite comfortably say that it's better than those two performances.
Big claim.
It's just, it's so different. You know, it's kind of a little bit like Leonardo DiCaprio in The Wolf of Wall Street. You're watching a guy here who is a douchebag. Like, he's not a nice person. I mean, this guy is a groomer. He's, you know, he's flirting with underage girls to try and make him become the next porn star. He's definitely a very selfish man. And yet he's likable. He has this likability about him. It's hard not to like him. It's hard not to enjoy when he's on screen.
He has a charm about him, doesn't he? He definitely has a charm about him. Hence why he seems to get himself places, hence why things seem to almost work out for him every single time. Even when he's down in the dumps, he seems to put himself out somehow. And that's mainly down to his charm, isn't it? Especially at the beginning of the movie, he manages to get into that house and sleep on the sofa. And he doesn't just sleep on the sofa, he manages to get into bed, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it, it's one of those things. He's kind of like that man who, like, I'm a changed man, but he never changes. He's that guy who proclaims he's changed and he's a good person. You know, I'm not the old me. I'm new. I'm reformed. Like, you can trust me. But then he is still the same person, still doing the same shit. He can't help himself. He is that guy. Yeah, we're just seeing a car crash. He is just selfish. He wants to get back in the industry. He sees himself as a star, as you said, and he sees himself. He sees Strawberry as his ticket back into the porn world. By basically,
do you want to explain who Strawberry is?
So Strawberry is a young woman. I think she was 17 when he meets her.
Yeah,
she works in the donut. I think it's Donut Time. Is it called Donut Time? It's a donut shop.
I actually think it might just be called Donut Shop. I think it might be called Donut Time.
Donut Time, I think, is actually a real place in London. So I apologize to Donut Time. Donut Shop. He ends up going there.
It might be Donut Time.
Maybe, who knows? It's a donut shop. It's a typical American-looking donut shop from what I've seen when watching The Simpsons. So I imagine they all look like this. And he comes up with the rent in advance, doesn't he? And he takes Lexi and Lil? Lil to the donut shop to celebrate. And he's like, you know, get what you want. And this is where he meets Strawberry, who's working in the donut shop. And he is instantly infatuated with her straight away, and we know straight away from the way it's shot, his look on his face, that this idiot is going to come back to this shop at some point. And he takes them all the way home. Not even
at some point.
He can't help himself. He gets all the way back home and then he goes, I forgot. What did he forget? He forgot something.
What did he forget? He left something there, didn't he? Oh, his cigarettes, was it? Something like that.
He's like, I've got to go back and get it.
Papers or something like that.
Yeah. He's like, as soon as they get to the front door, shit, I got to go back. He jumps on the bike, cycles all over there, and it's shut. But he does return, and he basically just manages to make her a bit of a weed customer, doesn't he? He manages to gives her weed. He manages to get in. That's part of a grooming technique, giving young people alcohol and drugs. He manages to get into the shop and kind of work as like...
We've got to catch a predator.
Exactly. This is like a starter pack to catch a predator. he manages to get himself in a position. Again, he worms his way into places. He gets in a position where he's behind the counter selling weed to construction workers on their clock, isn't he? And that's sort of his way of being around her all the time, and whilst he's having sort of what would you call it in the beginning?
An affair, let's say.
It's kind of like an affair, but he's not really with anyone. He's not with Lexi, is he?
Well, he is with Lexi. I mean, they're still technically married, and he's having sex with her and staying in the house, and I think it's assumed that they've now come back together. And Strawberry, as we know, has a boyfriend.
She did have a boyfriend. Mikey does the whole... It's kind of like something that would happen to, like, if a college guy was dating a high school girl and then he's like, hey, you know, she's with me now. She's with a man now, big boy. And he's only, like, fucking 17 and the boy's, like, 16 or something. He goes to...
I think the best thing about that is... how he acts more childish than the child that he's attacking is when he says, Google my name, you're out of your league. It's like he honestly thinks, because I'm a porn star, like I she'll just naturally go, you're out of your league.
Yeah, you're out of your depth, son. You ain't coming nowhere near this. And then he basically causes a scene. They go to his house, causes a scene, basically gets her to, he forces her to tell him that it's over. And it's like, she's with me now, you know. It's so like, it's proper high school shit. And then the boyfriend turns up at the donut shop with his mum and dad, who are tough. And this scene is good when they have a little fight, because typical Mikey comes out, gives it the big in, and then gets his ass handed to him by the dad, doesn't he? I can't remember what he says to them. He's like, kind of like, yeah, you needed like three people to take me on or something like that. Even when he's losing, he's winning in his own head. You know what I mean?
And what's funny about that scene is if you actually look at the facts, like, because of how Sean Baker films everything, There was actually someone that phoned the police when they did that.
They
scene.
Thought it was a real fight. Like, yeah.
They legitimately thought it was a real fight, so they phoned the police to break it up.
That is funny. You gotta love that. You gotta love that. Well, there were some like long shots, weren't there, where there were no camera crew around them while it was happening. So I imagine in those moments, it probably looks kind of real. You gotta love that. That is good. So that is who Strawberry is. Strawberry, 17-year-old girl working at a donut shop. And Mikey is grooming her to become a porn star. It's awful, really, isn't it?
And he's so proud of himself. Yeah. Like he feels like an entrepreneur. He feels like it honestly feels like it's a weird remake of A Star Is Born. This is honestly what this movie
in
is.
His
this
head
is. A Star Is Born, or A Star Is Porn.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. Maybe that's good. Yeah. He feels like. Right, in his head, he's like a scout, and he's discovered the next big star in porn. That's really what he thinks. And he doesn't look at it in any other way apart from, she's going to make me rich. That's literally how he looks at it. Typical Mike.
And it feels like this has been a common recycle. Mm. I mean, it's sort of hinted at, we never see it, because we always hear the story. I think that's what's interesting about this movie. We always hear the past from Mikey's point of view. Like, we never hear it from Lexi's or anybody else. Like, Lexi never kind of says what Mikey was like, why they broke up. But Mikey paints the picture to Lonnie. Obviously, Lonnie's sort of like the person he feeds the information to. But it's false information, because you can tell this guy's not trustworthy.
Mm, no, he's not.
So
he's not trustworthy.
And you wonder whether what happened to Strawberry is probably what happened to Lexi. He did the same thing. Let's go to Hollywood. Let's do porn.
And he'll drop her.
He got bored of her. And he found someone else. And it feels like this is like a common recycle of, he needs to stay on top.
He needs to stay relevant. He's hopping on the next thing. He's like, Lexi's all dried up. You know, she's done in this industry. I'm going to jump on the next big thing coming through. That does feel like what he's doing. And to be fair, he gets his comeuppance in a way, kind of. I was kind of
in a big way.
In a big way, but I was kind of surprised that he told them he was leaving. I was sort of thinking, this isn't going to go down well.
I thought he was just going to like run out the back door in the middle of the night.
Probably should have done that, considering the situation he'd got himself into and the fact that no one trusts him. But
yeah, I think they all kind of instinctively knew what he was doing. I think he always felt smarter than everybody else, but I think they all kind of got the hint. I mean, he was gone for long periods of time.
Yes.
It's like, something's strange here,
something's not up. But yeah, he was basically gonna leave with that, what was it, $3,000 that he saved up.
Yeah, something like that.
$3,000 that he saved up and from selling weed. But then it was over for him. And this scene's good. This scene's really good. When they burst into his room, they take the money from under his bed. It's the brother and the sister argument during the whole thing that's great.
This feels the most improvised scene.
Yeah, this is one of the funniest scenes. It's one of the funniest like back and forths between like the siblings. It's proper sibling behavior. Like, she's like, what the fuck are you doing? I'm not fucking taking you here with me next time. I didn't do anything. He's like, I didn't sign up for this. The bloke's naked in the bed. He's just fuming that he has to deal with that. That whole bit's really good. Those characters are really good. And then Mikey escapes quick, doesn't he? He's like, I need 30 seconds to put on some pants and stuff. And he just jumps straight out the window. He's gone. And like, this guy is, this is just him all over, isn't it? You know, he's on the run constantly and he's used to this. He's not his first rodeo.
He does feel like a fleeing rat from the sinking ship. Yeah. He's honestly someone who just gets out. It's funny, he's just that kind of guy that I just think for his whole life is always going to be the guy that gets beaten up. He always feels he's going to be on top and then someone's just going to find out who he is and just snatch it from underneath him.
And fair play to Simon Rex. He goes full frontal in this scene. I kind of saw it coming in a way. But it happens.
I think they had to kind of show you.
It's good commitment. It is good commitment from an actor whenever they go full frontal. You got, especially running. What's the word?
It's not very attractive.
Flattering. It's not very flattering. No, that's what I'm looking for.
Especially for a man.
Yeah, it's not. In the cold night of day, it's flapping around. Not good. Yeah, so fair play to him for going all out there. So Simon Rex really put his heart and soul into this role, didn't he? Really, really good. And then it kind of leaves us at the end. It's very ambiguous, the end. Did he imagine all that? Who knows?
Yeah, he did. I imagine that the end kind of leaves you the fact of what he's going to do. I think we all know what's going to happen. I don't think we need that door to open to know that it's probably ended. His idea of running away with strawberries probably ended.
Yeah. You kind of wonder what's next to him, don't you? Like, where do you go from there? Where does he go from there?
He's probably thinking of the next lie. Maybe he got beat up. Like, he'll say, he got beat up on the way there. And, you know, can he stay there and seek refuge for a bit? It leaves it open-ended. Like, are we back to the beginning of, like, when he came off that bus when he was all beaten up and, you know, disheveled? Is the end the start of Red Rocket 2, where basically it's basically a remake of the first one, where he's back and he's staying at hers and then... But he doesn't like being at hers and he finds another girl, you know. So I think there's this common recycle with the Mikey character. I think he's one of them characters, my kind of character. I like these kind of characters in movies. The character that doesn't learn. it's kind of, David Fincher said that he likes characters that in the end don't learn anything from their mistakes. And I kind of like that because it's very human. And that's what Mikey feels to me. Mikey doesn't feel like there's redemption, like he's going to turn a new leaf. It feels like he's just going to do the same shit until the end of time.
Yeah, it does feel like that. And that's kind of real life as well. People are who they are sometimes.
Especially for people like that. Yeah. You know, those people are parasites. They do leech onto people. And Mikey's definitely a leech. He leeched onto everybody and he sort of uses them. And he doesn't really like anybody. It makes you wonder if he even likes himself.
He's always
got to big himself up and talk about how wonderful he is. And like when he talks about the award shows and how he didn't win for best performance and how there was an uproar and everybody was booing and it was a big snub of the night. You know, it just feels like... It feels like he's replaying. You know, when you were talking about the music video at the end, it feels like he would pay, like, if he shoe his life, one, it would be in rose-tinted glasses, and the other thing, it would be such triumphant music for such a negative life and outcome.
Exactly. And not only that, he does have to pop a Viagra every time he wants to perform. So
only, not with
Strawberry. Not with Strawberry, just with Lexi.
Just for Lexi.
It just shows you how bored of Lexi he really is. But he's a professional.
Just coming on set.
He will perform. That's the way he sees. Yeah, he sees her as like a co-worker. But this movie was great. It surprised me, and I knew it was talked about as one of the best movies of last year. It was up there. One of those near misses for the for like the circuit in terms of accolades. It obviously did well at Cannes.
So overlooked, this movie. And to be fair, Sean Baker's movies have often been overlooked. I think probably the closest one to making a break was The Florida Project. Mm. In the end, I think they're like best supporting actor for William Dafoe. But I think you know, the writing and the direction. And this one is probably like, I look at the movies that are out last year and I think definitely this could have gone for Best Picture. I think it's definitely, for me, a top 10 movie. Being my, I can't imagine this not being in my top 10.
Yeah, I think, that's a good point. This probably could make my top 10 as well, actually.
I mean, one day we're going to do our retrospective awards thing in our top six and blah, blah, blah. And it'll be interesting to see where this one lies. I think this will be a heavy hitter for me. And I think I'd like to see, I don't know what Simon Rex has got on the pipeline next, but I'd like to see him do more interesting work. It's always great. I find it interesting when an actor comes out and surprises you. And this is one of the biggest surprises, because this is not an actor that I would immediately thought, I'm going to say, oh yeah, he should be nominated for an Oscar and he should win an Oscar, because I've never seen him in a performance that, I don't think I've ever seen a performance that I would say amazing. I'm not saying he's bad in anything. I've just never seen him in anything where he stood out so much.
I don't think he's ever really had a lead, has he? Like a proper lead in a film.
I mean, he was good in Scary Movie 3. I mean, he was funny. But like,
he was a character in it, but he was a character. The lead. But in terms of like a real movie, the lead is in a real movie. It's definitely the first one I've seen anyway. But he is in a new movie coming up, which is currently filming. Pussy Island he is in, which is Zoe Kravitz's movie that she's directing.
Obviously sounds like a sequel to Red Rocket.
It does, yeah, it does. It does. He's not the lead in this, but he is starring alongside Channing Tatum and Naomi Aki. Like, yeah, there's some big people in this movie. There's some big people in this movie. So, yeah, that'll be interesting. Zoe Kravitz is...
Well, I hope this movie's pushed him into the limelight a little bit more.
I hope so too, because he kind of feels like one of those ones who's been in the industry for a while and hasn't really had his shot in terms of maybe what he wants to do. And Sean Baker sort of eyed him out. Apparently, eyed him out 5 years ago for this role, but never introduced himself until 2020, and that was when he convinced him to send him an audition tape and do all that. And as you say, he learned his lines within a couple of days of getting them. But he's had an interesting career, to say the least. Simon Rex also did star in his own solo porn movies before establishing an acting career as well. So
maybe that's why he chose.
Exactly. It's sort of a little nudge to maybe his past there a little bit. So that's interesting.
I think this movie works with a comedian at the helm or a comedic actor, and I think that's another reason. No, I think this actor has to kind of feel like he's in. It feels like it's kind of like a movie where it feels like the main actor thinks he's in a slapstick comedy.
Mm.
And that works so well, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, he does. He thinks he's a star as well. He thinks he lights up a room when he walks in. Mm. And it's good. But I love the realism in this movie as well. The scene where he goes into the donut shop and he goes to chat her up, and then the construction workers start pouring in and he's awkwardly on the side, and then he's like, what time do you get quiet? And then he's like, I'll come back then. That scene's good. So not everything is perfect in this movie. Things are, you know, there are obstacles like real life approaching the character. So I like that. I like little things like that. Small cast, very unknown cast. I think Simon Rex is probably the most known actor in this, and he's relatively small as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so who was your favourite out of the unknowns?
It's a hard one. I liked a little bit of all of them. So I liked Brie Elrod, who played Lexi, and I liked Brenda Dees in Lil. I liked the Mikey, Lexi, Lil combination. I liked Brittany Rodriguez, who played June. I thought she was very interesting. She kind of, I was always waiting for her to do something incredible. You know, it kind of reminded me of The Simpsons. We were the Yakuza who fight the Italian muff, and you got the guy in the white suit who's just standing there doing nothing, and I just I want to see what he does. And that's kind of like what she was for me. I was waiting for her to break out and do something. And of course, Ethan Darborn as Lonnie, so and even Susanna's son as Strawberry, who is I looked, she's about 26.
She's 26,
and I thought this
yeah.
is probably. She's one of the most convincing, because she really does look like she could be 15. and her performance is really adolescent. It really feels like this is a teenager. You know, the way she is, the way she acts. She's kind of googly-eyed all over this Mikey. She thinks, because he's an older man and he says all these wonderful things, he's like the perfect man for her, and he's got all his shit together. And he's the polar opposite of everything she thinks. And she's sort of naively trusting this predator, basically,
yeah,
to ruin her life.
pretty much.
There's only one way with Mike, and that's downhill. Like, you might go uphill for a little bit, but then you're going to go downhill. Hey. Because I think Mike Lee is the catalyst of all of his own problems.
Yeah, he, like you say, he is a parasite. If you let him in, then he is going to ruin you in some shape or form. He is going to be a nuisance. He's like mold, isn't he? He's just like mold. It will slowly kill you, basically. Interested about her. This obviously was her first film as well. Sean Baker actually he asked her to audition, but he didn't call her back for 2 years, apparently. And then Sean Baker, being the way he is, he didn't call her back for 2 years. And then he discovered that she taught piano, and decided to write. The first thing, the 2 year thing, is how is he organizing this, in the sense that he's like, 2 years time, I'm going to call her back. Hopefully she won't have made it in the film. I think that's crazy. But
I think it's more like funding. I honestly maybe. Think like, I imagine, you know, the scope that Sean Baker works.
She probably assumes she didn't get it.
More in terms of funding. Probably, or, you know,
you
mean,
would.
Let's be honest, it must happen so often. Like, how many times have actors been told something that it never happens? And sometimes it does happen, sometimes it doesn't. You know, it's a continuous... a cycle. It's like 15 minutes of fame. You're always on top for so long.
Mm.
Especially in that. There's such a big pull, isn't there? In terms of acting.
Yeah, it is. I just find that weird. I find the world of film is kind of strange in that sense. He also discovered that she taught piano. So he wrote that scene in where she does her cover version of Bye 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 by NSYNC, which is brilliant. Brilliant scene.
I thought it's one of my favourite scenes of like this predator is taken away, something that she's actually really gifted at, which is singing and the piano, yeah, to become a porn star.
To make her a porn star.
Like he could make her into like a singer or push a music career. Instead he wants to take her to porn. I thought that was a really good, I can see why he was probably even more interested in her now, because it's like extra layers onto the character. But what I like about it is it's not so in your face, like it's so obvious. It just happens, and then you kind of, even if you don't know it, you can kind of connect the two and understand that what she's really good at and what he wants to take her away from. I think that was also brilliant that she was naked at the time. Didn't it? Not just because she's naked, but I mean, it just adds to what was happening at that point.
It does. It adds to the madness of it, of the whole situation. Yeah. Interestingly, with that song was very prominent in the film. Interestingly, all five members of NSYNC approved of her cover for the movie, so that includes Mr. Justin Timberlake, who would have approved this song for this film, which is kind of interesting. That's quite cool. I did like the Bye Bye, because it doesn't feel like that should be in a serious movie, that song, but it somehow works.
Yeah, it works
at the end.
It works
start.
Very well.
Really odd, but it does work. So yeah, this movie, good, bad, or what the fuck?
Oh, it's good. It's probably up there with one of the best things we've ever reviewed, I think.
Wow, that's we should definitely do an award ceremony for films we've reviewed. Actually, that is that's definitely an interesting idea, to go back through the films we've reviewed and rank them after a certain milestone of episodes. Maybe not 100, because we already have that one set. Yeah, I'd also put this one in good. This was a good movie, and I was glad I chose it. I've been intrigued about this. At the start of the year, I wrote a list of movies I want to watch this year. This was in there. So I went through that before choosing. I was thinking, that one stands out. That's a really interesting collaboration, Simon Rex and Sean Baker. If you know the both of them, you'd be very intrigued to watch that movie.
And if you don't know any of them, you'd still be intrigued, because it's a good movie regardless of what you know going in.
You should be. But yeah, highly recommend this movie. It's just, yeah, it's one of those movies that I was watching, I was like, where is this going? I mean, it's about the characters. It's just movies about the characters, which I do love. I love movies just about people.
I know when I'm watching a good movie is if, like, for 5 minutes we just watch them drink milk, you know, I can, or just eat donuts. I know I like a movie when, like, the most mundane thing happens and I'm kind of still hooked.
Yeah, there you go. That's a big compliment there. So both in good, and we'll move on to our top five.
Number
So top five this week on the topic of unknown actors, actresses. I thought we'd do top five actors, actresses that burst onto the scene and stole the show in whatever movie. So basically, at the time of the film being released, no one really knew who they were, especially to like a main, let's say mainstream audience, worldwide audience, let's say that. Mm-hmm. So they may be, they could be known in where they're from, but
I've done it differently to you.
Well, that's not right then, is it?
Well, because I thought when you said it, I in my head went top five non-actor performances. So I went with
okay,
with again the same thing as you. The fact that their movie that they were like their breakout movie, they weren't actors. They were something else, and they were brought in because they fitted the part or for various other reasons. Whether they went on to become actors afterwards is regardless of the fact, but the first movie or the movie that I've selected them in, they were non-actors. They never had any big acting experience before.
That's fair enough. That's fine. That's most of my list anyway, but there is two.
Tom Cruise.
There is two that were actors, but not really. They were, but very, very well. One was really minor. The other one had a few films, which is my first one I'll start with. Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go first.
Number five, I went for Melanie Laurent in Inglourious Basterds. So this is the most actor, the most present actor out of my whole list. Had started a few French films before, but. Yeah, this was like a breakthrough Hollywood role where she was really noticed, and it was delivered by Quentin Tarantino, who didn't just do one with this movie, he did two. And Christoph Waltz, obviously he gets a lot of the attention in terms of that, but I think she deserves a special mention as well. She actually abandoned a play that she was due to direct in France when she got cast as Inglourious Basterds. I just think she was really good in this film. She brought like an extra element to the movie. Her character was really important, and to be fair, the scenes with her in were, you would almost think like with the scenes with the scalping and all that stuff, like they were the cool scenes, and like the other bit was just like filler, boring, whatever. I actually think her scenes were the best scenes, and I think her storyline was probably the best storyline in Inglourious Basterds, which is my favorite Tarantino movie.
I'd say she's probably one of Tarantino's best
discoveries.
Not best discoveries, best characters he's ever written.
Yeah.
She was. I'd say she was kind of like the underplayed. The story was mainly her story. I think Christoph Waltz always gets the accolades and rightly so. It's as much as I like Melanie Laurent, I would say Christoph Waltz and Inglourious Basterds is probably in. Perhaps the top three Tarantino characters ever.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about up there with like Samuel Jackson and Pulp Fiction and probably I can't even think of another one. But you know, there's so many. But you know, one day we have to do a Tarantino character ranking list one day. Maybe when he retires.
He will retire.
he will retire. And I think that'd be an interesting list. It's a great inclusion. She is brilliant. She is the heart and soul of the story.
She really is.
And I mean, one of the kick-ass best renditions of David Bowie's what's the song called? Get the Cat People one, Gasoline. The song, you know, when she's getting ready to torch the cinema.
Cat People.
Was it called Cat People?
It was called Cat People, yeah, David Bowie.
Cat People. I love that song, and that version of it in that was perfect.
Yeah, that's such...
And especially the little montage for her getting ready.
Yeah, that scene's brilliant. I mean, that scene coming to a head when eventually, spoiler alert, in case you haven't seen the movie, when Hitler gets shot at. I mean, absolutely.
No spoiler. If you haven't seen Inglourious Basterds, I don't know what you're doing. Decimated. Listen to us.
Her scenes are brilliant, and I just love that movie. That movie just stands out as the best Tarantino movie for me. You may disagree, but I can't look past it. I just love that movie.
It'd probably be like third or fourth for me. I mean,
fucking brilliant, that movie.
It's hard not to say Pulp Fiction.
It is hard not to, if you were like, watch one Tarantino movie for the rest of your life, I would go with that movie. I would have to. But that's my number five. What's your number five?
My number five comes from the same year, actually. It comes from 2009. Kate Jarvis in Fish Tank.
Okay, that's good.
Now she was discovered by the casting agent when her casting agent, the director's casting agent, saw her arguing with her boyfriend in Tilbury Town railway station.
Yes, I knew about this. I love this movie as well. It's good.
I love this movie, and I think it's how authentic she is. And I just knew girls like her, like growing up. I knew girls like that, and she just feels so authentic.
Right.
I can just imagine that she used to go to my high school. She was someone that I knew, you know, so there's so much realism there. Andrea Arnold is another one, a lot like Sean Baker, who likes to use non-professional actors. And in her last movie, she had non-professional cows. So she's doing very well. I love the, because this is very early doors. Again, funny enough, another movie that stars Michael Fassbender, because he was in Inglourious Basterds. Wow. This was before he was famous. He was in Inglourious Basterds. And he was in this one, which a lot like
Red Rocket.
Red Rocket, of a man who's seducing a teenager. It's a great performance, and it's, again, so authentic. It's so British. I don't know how this translates for other countries across the world who have ever seen it. But for me, I do like a good British independent drama. And this is, I'd say, a very good British independent drama.
That's a good story as well. I love that she just saw her argue with her boyfriend. I was just like, perfect. That's exactly who I'm looking for. I would love to have heard the conversation between them. Imagine they go out to go, hi. Like, she would have been all pent up from arguing, but hi, I'm looking to cast a movie. Imagine just going, fuck off.
Just go away.
Fuck off. I can just imagine something like that happen. Fassbender getting a double mention in a week. What a week for Mr. Fassbender.
But not even. He's got a double mention, but not really ever mentioned.
Not mentioned, no. Kate Jarvis, what does she do after this? What has she done since?
She did like some EastEnders work, I think.
Yeah. So she's done any movies. No, she hasn't really. I mean, she's done a few movies, but none of them. Rise of the Foot Soldier, Origins. Are they ever going to stop making these Rise of the Foot Soldier movies? Fucking hell.
I think I saw the first one and I didn't really like it that much.
They've made about 50. Fucking never ends. Yeah, she was in EastEnders. Hayley Slater. She did 108 episodes.
There you go.
She was a fucking Slater. That's perfect. That's it.
Anyone that doesn't understand a Slater is a Slater in a soap opera EastEnders world is a good cast.
You're part of
them. It's a well-known family.
You're part of, yeah.
The Mitchells and the Slaters, you're doing well.
You're part of a famous family there.
The footnote of history right there.
I was just looking about how she, because she's no longer on it. So I always wonder what happens to the characters when that happened. But basically, if EastEnders, if you either get killed or if you leave the street, you're gone forever. If you're leaving the street, it's like leaving Earth. You know, no one's ever hears from you again. You don't come visit. Fucking nothing happens.
It's basically like Field of Dreams with the corn. If you go too far into the corn, you go to some other afterlife.
Basically. They actually made her go a little bit dill-lally on here, and she was suicidal, and she fleed and left a note, and that is it. That was the end.
Gone
of her.
Fishing.
That
was the end. Don't call me.
Yeah, that was the end of her. Anyway, that's a good one. I didn't even think about that one. That's a really good one. My number four. It'd be silly not to mention. We're talking Sean Baker, so we have to mention two very important characters. And I have to band them together. It's hard just to do one. The two stars of Tangerine, Katana Kiki Rodriguez and Maya Taylor, in Tangerine. Obviously, no acting experience whatsoever. And they were kind of, in a way, playing themselves, because Maya was a real life sex worker for 5 years before she was in this movie. They were both discovered at a local LGBT center in Los Angeles, and they were both living together as well. And they also improvised a lot of their lines. So this was kind of like, they were kind of like playing weird versions of themselves in a way. Brilliant casting. A weird movie. I watched it for the first time with you because you said this is a Christmas movie. You were like, we're going to put this movie on as Tangerine. It's a really good Christmas movie.
Was it not in our top 50 Christmas movies by the end?
I don't know if it made it. Did it make it?
It did make it. It was high up there.
It was high up there because it's set on Christmas Eve. Again, a donut shop is in this movie. That's his thing as well. Puke and donut shops. Is that his thing? Have we discovered his thing? We'll see in the next movie. If he has a donut shop in his next movie, that's his thing. I don't know if there's one in Florida Project. I can't remember. There might be one in there.
I think most of it's set in a motel, from what I remember.
Let me have a look if there's a donut shop in there.
Motel overlooking Disneyland.
Oh, it kind of is. It kind of is. They have a sweet shop. Like a cupcake shop thing, don't they?
Cupcake's basically a donut which hasn't got a hole in it.
Yeah, isn't every pastry a donut without a hole in it? Anyway, yeah. Tangerine. these two in Tangerine, brilliant. Maya Taylor has gone on to do a few bits afterwards as well. Recently been cast in...
Well, she was the best one, I thought, Maya Taylor out of the two.
She was the best one. She seemed like she really... And that's nothing on Kiki, as though Kiki was good. But yeah, Maya's been cast in Dietland, 3 episodes of Dietland, been in a few things. Happy Birthday, Marsha, Stage Mother, etc. So... I don't know why I did that. So they've kind of built a career out of it. It's kind of like a nice story as well, because they may have been in a bad place before they were in this movie, based on their lives.
It's a very good inclusion. I didn't put them in the honourable mention, but talking about a bad place, funny enough how our ones have been aligning so far. My number 4 comes from a bad place.
Go on.
And that is Ariel Holmes in Heaven Knows What. Now, this is a Safdie Brothers movie, early Safdie Brothers movie, which was made in 2004. Now, John and Benny Safdie discovered Holmes for another project they were working on, which eventually got scratched. But they were intrigued by her life story because she was a heroin user, she was a crack cocaine user. And so... the Safdies encouraged her to write a memoir, paying her by the page, and then from the memoir, they used that as a basis for their movie, Heaven Knows What, which is about her and her boyfriend kind of struggling with their drug addiction. And it's probably the bleakest drug movie because it's the most real. And Requiem for the Dream has always been considered the most bleakest, but this feels the most real. It's the most grounded, and it is hard. It is a hard movie to watch. It stars your boy, Caleb Landry Jones. He plays the boyfriend. And the one great thing about this, it does have a very happy ending, is after the completion of Heaven Knows What, Ariel Holmes did ask the Safdie brothers to assist with her rehabilitation. So she received treatment at a retreatment center, and I don't know what her state of play is at the moment, but let's fingers crossed hope that she's in a good place. But she was brilliant in this movie for the fact that she was weird to say it, she was a crack cocaine addict, that it felt so real, if you know what I mean. It felt like you were really watching a documentary. And it's one of those movies where she's not really gone on to do anything else, but it's like this was her role. You know, it doesn't matter if there was no other role for her. This was her role. I don't know what she's doing now, but this was her role. And so it feels like no one else could play her role. And this was completely her. This was her story. And I kind of like that. And again, we talked about the Safdies. They're a lot like Sean Baker. They like to mix real actors with non-professionals, and this is probably the best example of it, Heaven Knows What.
I've never seen Heaven Knows What, but I'm immediately intrigued.
I think you can find it on Sky Cinema. It might be on Sky Cinema somewhere.
Maybe I'll have a look.
You'd like it. It's very good. It's a very good movie.
They have got a good track record, the Safdies. So I trust them. I will watch it and enjoy it. I love Good Time. Loved Uncut Gems. So probably would love it as well. My number three is Lupita Nyong from 12 Years a Slave is my number three. Again, this is, I would say, maybe out of everyone in my list, this is the one that has skyrocketed in terms of her career. So before she was cast in 12 Years a Slave, she had just done a short film called East River in 2008, and then went to university, studied at Yale, and then straight out of Yale got cast in 12 Years a Slave. And after that has been in some of the biggest movies of the last 10 years. Star Wars, Jungle Book, Star Wars again, Black Panther, Us. She's been in some massive, massive movies. So I'd just say the way this role really skyrocketed her, considering it was her first feature movie, is kind of huge, and she was great in it as well. It's a very good movie, 12 Years a Slave. Very difficult movie to watch, because it is so... I think it's just in terms of its accuracy, I think it's trying to be as accurate as humanly possible. I don't know how accurate it is.
Well, it's based on the memoirs.
Yeah.
So
I think a lot of people said it was pretty, never seen a film represent slavery so accurately, was what sort of people said. So that's it's one of those movies that is tough to watch, but it's an important movie to watch, I'd say. And Steve McQueen is a brilliant director too. So I don't know how he discovered her though, how he came about her. That's one story I seem to be missing. Because you've had some good stories about the discovery of people, and now I feel silly. So I'm going to look at it now. I've got the others of the discovery, but because she did sort of come out of nowhere, didn't she? She really.
This is one of her first roles. I can't remember if she did more like internet work before. I think that might have been where she was found.
Yeah, and it was a huge, huge movie. Took home countless Oscars. I'm just reading now in real time where she was discovered. Maybe she auditioned. Maybe she auditioned. Anyway, I can't find a good story about how she was discovered, but I think in terms of everyone on my list who career skyrocketed straight away, sensation overnight, pretty much. Really good success story from her. That's my number three.
It's, I've always considered 12 Years a Slave a masterpiece. I'm a big Steve McQueen fan, self-confessed. I remember watching this in the cinema. I've always state claimed that this is maybe one of the great movies ever made. It's up there for me. I think in terms of why he cast her, I think, again, he kind of likes actors that are not too... I think for that role, if you had like a known name, I think it would have stood out too much. And I think the fact that the character Patsy has to feel a little bit like unknown, like unknown how important this character could be in the story. And I think it really works. And she won an Oscar for it as well. So that's another.
Exactly. I think that's good casting as well, because then you connect with the character rather than if they put a big name in there, sometimes you can disconnect from the movie and just be looking at a big name playing a character.
I've always felt that's the weird thing about when Brad Pitt turns up. I like Brad Pitt, but it always feels weird when you see him in this movie, because everyone else feels so, not famous. Even Fassbender wasn't massively famous at this point. That when you see Brad Pitt, it kind of is a bit like, whoa, what are you doing in this?
Another mention for Fassbender. I was trying to avoid a Fassbender mention.
You have done a lot of Fassbenders.
Another Fassbender. But, you know, these frequent collaborators. He also did Shame with Fassbender, which is a great movie. Brilliant movie.
Mm-hmm. And Hunger
as well. So, yeah, they They connect, those two. But yeah, that's my number three.
For the third time in a row, we have a connection again. We have a weird connection because my number three is also from 2013 and was also an Oscar player, and he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, as Lupita Nyong'o was nominated and won for Best Supporting Actress. So I'm talking about Barkhad Abdi in Captain Phillips. I love this movie. I remember seeing it in the cinema. Barkhad Abdi, before this was his first movie, before he was a limousine driver and like on the side like a DJ, and like to cast this movie, like there was like a worldwide search for like the Somalian pirates, and there were like 700 people that they chose from, and they whittled it down to like four. They had like groups, they put them in groups, and the four that they picked, he was of that four in the four groups, which then went on to make the movie, and they just decided out of the four which one would be the leader, and that was Barkhad Abdi. And I mean, what a great, to go toe to toe with Tom Hanks is incredible. And you know, he hasn't really done much afterwards. He always feels like he's got little cameo roles in movies. I kind of like to see him in movies. But I do think it's such a great performance because it feels so real. It doesn't feel like an actor. And like that movie itself is so adrenaline rushing. You watch it and you're on the edge of your seat, and it feels like a documentary because Paul Greengrass used to be a documentary filmmaker, so he sort of left that kind of style in his work. And it's so heartbreaking as well. His character's like journey. And yeah, I just think it's definitely up there. It's one of the most memorable non-actor stand-ups that I've ever seen.
He also left with an eternal meme as well, and a very famous line: "I am the captain now."
I'm the captain now. Yeah,
that is eternal. Even if you've never seen the movie, you've seen that line for sure.
And you need to watch that movie. I mean, weirdly enough, the two movies that I cried at when I watched at the cinema, well, the two we just talked about, 12 Years a Slave and Captain Phillips. I cried at the end of 12 Years a Slave because that was hard. And Captain Phillips, I was like on the edge of my seat. That by the end, when Tom Hanks breaks down, I started to like kind of like teary eyed a little bit because I was like, "Is it over? Can I sit back now?" So yeah, it's weird. The two movies that made me cry. Number three.
Well, there you go. This is top five movies that made Peter cry at the moment.
Top 10.
Top
50.
Number two. I also went for an unknown, not an actor, someone who was discovered and casted for a role. I'd be surprised if you didn't have this in your list. You may have this in your list. Will Sampson, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The Chief. Not in your list?
No,
wow.
I
thought this.
Not on my list.
Oh, I put this one in. I was like, I'm sure we'll have a match on this one. Yeah, Samson, not an actor. He was discovered because he competed in rodeos for about 20 years. His specialty was bronco busting, and so he was on the rodeo circuit when the producers discovered him. They were looking for a large Native American to play the role of Chief, and Samson, at 6'7", stood out to them. And apparently it actually took a while for them to really get in contact with them. But they hired him on a straightforward interview, and it was his first ever acting role. And if you think of that movie, you really do think of the Chief, don't you? It's hard not to. Like, he is a very, very memorable character in this movie. And he plays an important role in this movie as well. And he went on to do a bit afterwards. He didn't really have the career, maybe. Well, he didn't really star in.
I remember being in Poltergeist 2.
Yeah, he was in Poltergeist 2. Yeah, he didn't really go on to have a career in terms of being in a movie as successful as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But he actually did have a credit before that. And no, in the same year, I don't know if it came out first, he had an uncredited role in Crazy Mama, where he was just kind of like an extra. Basically, I think that must have been after June 1975 versus November 1975. Maybe it was filmed after. I don't know. That seems very odd that he had an acting credit before he was in his first ever movie. But yeah, he just stood out. I imagine when they first saw him, they were like, wow, he's perfect. And what a legendary movie. What a legacy to leave behind.
It's one of my favorite movies. It's probably up there in my top five. I didn't actually know he was a non-professional actor, so there you go.
Did you not know that?
That was all over my eyes. I did not know that one.
Wow. Yeah, no, he did Bronco Busting for 20 years, which is basically where you ride a bucking horse that attempts to throw you off. You know, you ride it kind of, I don't want to say bareback, but I suppose it is bareback. Bareback's just a word that's not used for this anymore. You ride a horse and they try and throw you off. Imagine him, a 6'7" him on top of a horse. That horse struggled to throw that man off, surely. That's probably why he was so good. Probably why he did it for 20 years. Probably like, this man is on this horse for ages. Been breaking records. But yeah, very interesting that he got cast in that movie. But yeah, first time actor. And he passed away in 1987 when he was 53. So, R.I.P.
And I think he was another curse of Poltergeist too, because thing called the Poltergeist curse. A lot of people have been have died early on.
It was a year after the movie came out that he died. As well.
There was a lot of people who died because of the Poltergeist. Curse.
It's an interesting curse, actually. That is
it's a very interesting, weird little stain on history.
Yeah, very odd. But yeah, that's my number two.
My number two is Hang S. Nigar for The Killing Fields.
This is my number one. So.
Oh, this is your number one.
This is my number one.
So there we go. I mean, the story alone is the reason why. He was a survivor of the Cambodian, what do they call it? I have to pronounce it, the Khmer Rouge regime, and he was part of the labor camps. But he was actually spotted at a Cambodian wedding in Los Angeles where the casting agent found him. No prior acting before this. He was actually a doctor. And I mean, he stands out for me. It was between two actors who I didn't pick. It was either Howard Russell in The Best Years of Our Lives, but I hadn't seen The Best Years of Our Lives so many times that I could remember it that well. But the Hang S. Nigar, especially in the latter part, as soon as Sam Waterston and John Malkovich's characters leave, and then the second half of the story is Hang S. Nigar's sort of journey through Cambodia, through the labor camps, and getting back to his friend. That is so harrowing to watch. And he won an Oscar. And I mean, it is, again, like we were talking about with some of these actors, it feels like, yeah, he didn't do many movies after this, but this was his role. Like, no one else could have done this role other than Hank.
Yeah, he said himself, didn't he, that the movie will live on for years after he's gone, and he's proud of that. And obviously he wanted to tell the story as well for his deceased wife. It's quite sad as well how he died. He was sort of he was murdered, wasn't he? He was shot outside his home in Chinatown. It's quite a sad story about that. But yeah, he's a true unknown, isn't he? Coming in and then picking up an Oscar for your first feature is pretty incredible stuff, isn't it? That is probably one of the most surreal things ever. You know, you're just thrown into a movie and you play it with such, sometimes some roles, I guess you don't need to be an actor. If you play it with the heart and the soul of the role, and you have that connection to the story as well, then you can put on a performance like that. And yeah, there you go. Probably a lot of the scenes emotionally would have affected him really, like in real life. So, yeah, proper.
Oh, absolutely. It must have felt like reliving some of the past.
Exactly. Yeah, this is proper historical Probably stuck one. That's why I just thought there's for me there was nothing else that could be number one than this.
But and yet,
I suppose
I have
you have other
one.
Ideas.
I do. My number one, I'm surprised, is not in your top five. Because I remember I remember when we watched it together and we loved the beginning of it. And it began a love affair of Stanley Kubrick for me. That is Ali Ermey in Full Metal Jacket.
Ah, yeah.
Now, this is a very interesting story. I only learned this story like last year that originally Ali Ermey was a technical advisor. He was a technical advisor on Apocalypse Now and a few other war movies. And he was a technical advisor on Full Metal Jacket. He wasn't meant to play the drill sergeant. He was a technical advisor. There was another actor called Tim Colseri, which is a very interesting story if you ever want to look up the Tim Colseri Kubrick Ermey story, because that one is so heartbreaking for Tim Colseri, the actor who had such a great role that was denied from him, and then he got such a small little role as a helicopter gunner. And Ali Ermey became the drill sergeant because Kubrick decided that he just felt more intimidating. And I mean, Ali Ermey has gone on to make many movies after this. He's actually gone on to have quite a good Hollywood career. He always goes back to play the drill sergeant. So many times he goes back to play drill sergeant. And this one's so good. I mean, those opening scenes in the training camp center when he's breaking down these young soldiers. I mean, it just feels so authentic. And you can see why Kubrick went for him. He's intimidating. He's loud. He's in your face. He's a drill sergeant, so he's doing everything that he knows would happen. And there's something so powerful about that opening 40 minutes of the movie where you have Ali Ermey. He totally stands out. He shines above every other thing in that scene, in those scenes. And as a personal favorite of mine, it is, because it's one of my favorite movies of all time, and it's definitely one of my favorite performances.
He is incredible in this movie, isn't he? I mean, this again, one of the most memorable things is some of the lines he says. I do wonder if some of the lines are improvised. Any of them?
I think they are.
Do you think they are? Because some of the lines are fantastic. Like they're stuff that's almost too funny to write sometimes, or too.
Well, yeah. So apparently here it says Kubrick changed his mind after Ermey put together an instruction tape in which he went on an extended tirade on several extras, which convinced Kubrick he was the right man for the role. So I imagine when I hear that he probably, yeah, did Kubrick allowed Ermey to write or edit his own dialogue and improvise on the set, a notable rarity in Kubrick's films.
There you go. That is a big credit to Lee Ermey. That is a huge credit to Lee Ermey.
And probably a big credit to Kubrick knows when to step back. And I think that's a credit that he knows that he's writing cannot outbeat something so realistic as what he says. And what he says, I mean, he has some of the stuff he says, I still quote this day. I didn't know they stat shit that time and like stuff like that. Or you could suck a golf ball for a garden hose.
You could suck. Yeah, it's the delivery as well. The delivery is so perfect. Yeah. Like you almost feel like if you were insulted by him, you couldn't say anything back because you just stutter. Like so, he is the most intimidating character. He might be one of the most intimidating characters ever. Actually, he's got to be up there.
I think he's up there. I think he's definitely up there. I wouldn't want him to be my drill sergeant.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't either. I think it'd soon whip you into shape. You know what you're getting with this guy. You know, there's no messing around. This is a good number one. I didn't consider it. Why didn't I consider it? I'm just looking at some of his lines. Now, you're so ugly. You could be a modern art masterpiece. What's your name, fat body? Sir Leonard Lawrence. Sir Lawrence. Lawrence. What? Lawrence of Arabia.
He is. I mean, it is incredible. Some of the, especially that beginning scene, the introduction scene is just hilarious.
It is. This one's good as well. Do you think I'm cute, Private Pyle? Sir, no, sir. Then wipe that disgusting grin off your face. Sir, yes, sir. Well, any fucking time, sweetheart. sir.
And this is the bit, actually, when you think that this is the genius of that scene. It reminds me of Goodfellas, you know, when it's all funny and then he said you're a funny guy and he goes, what do you mean? And suddenly it gets serious. That scene there is kind of very similar where it's funny, we're laughing, and suddenly he chokes him out. And suddenly,
it becomes real again.
Is not serious anymore. This is like dangerous.
And yeah.
There's something really interesting about like the blend of it being funny to it being actually quite tragic.
It is. It's, some of the lines are very hard hitting, aren't they? Very, very hard. Like hitting to the core.
Absolutely.
Absolute core of everything. That's a great choice at number one. I credit you, sir. That concludes our top five. It's a pretty good top five, I'd say. Pretty successful. And we'll move on to what we're watching next week. So it's over to Peter. It's your turn to decide.
Okay, next week we're going to Amazon.
Oh.
Next week we're going back to the year 1976.
Oh.
And we're going to a cult classic here. We're going to the movie John Carpenter made before he made Halloween.
Go on.
I'm talking about Assault on Precinct 13. Now, if you don't know what Assault on Precinct 13 is, I will tell you. An unlikely partnership between a highway patrol officer, two criminals, and a station secretary is formed to defend a defunct Los Angeles precinct office against a siege by a bloodthirsty street gang.
Ooh. Low budget as well, this movie. $100,000 cost to make.
$100,000, and it is widely considered one of his best movies. I think it's up there. I think they said he did a string of five masterpieces. I don't know if they're five masterpieces, but they say it began with Assault on Precinct 13 and ended with The Thing. So that'd be Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Fog, Escape from New York, and The Thing.
Yeah, that's a pretty good run.
It's a pretty good run.
That's a
pretty good run. Even if at the time it wasn't, now looking back at it, it was.
Yeah, exactly. Greatness. Yeah, greatness will show up in time for sure.
And he's a director that we haven't touched yet, John Carpenter, someone that we both truly admire. And so I thought, let's go back to a movie that I've seen once. I don't have a great memory of it, so I wanted to relive this movie. I don't know if you've seen it before.
I've never seen it, but I am intrigued. I'm surprised we haven't explored a John Carpenter movie. We obviously did the new Halloween. I'm surprised Big Trouble in Little China hasn't come up yet. Maybe in time that will come up.
There's just so many movies, aren't there?
Yeah.
Assault on Precinct 13 might be a nice little entry into the world of Carpenter.
I like it. So that's on, is it Amazon Prime now?
Amazon Prime, yes.
Amazon Prime, free to watch. Lovely stuff. All right.
Free to watch.
We will catch you then. Join us next week. Same time as always, Monday, 10 a.m. UK time. Don't know what time it is where you are. I'm sure you'll tell me. Adios.
Goodbye.